So I'll go ahead and read. We're in John chapter 5, verses 1 through 19. It says, "After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, 'Do you want to be healed?' The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me.' Jesus said to him, 'Get up, take up your bed, and walk.' And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed.' But he answered them, 'The man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk.' They asked him, 'Who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?' Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father is working until now, and I am working.' This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." So throughout this gospel, if there's one thing that we've consistently seen from all the people that Jesus interacts with, it's this: they can't see their need. Think about it. If you just go back in John chapter 2, the Jews, they can't see their need for a new temple and new access to God through Jesus. In John chapter 3, Nicodemus, he can't see his need for new life and a new birth. In John chapter 4, the woman at Samaria, she can't see her need for a new thirst and an authentic worship to God. And so in each of these interactions, Jesus offers something that each of them desperately needs, but they don't know it. They can't see it. That's a pretty scary place to be in, right? I can think of at least two reasons. One, it speaks to the state of judgment and darkness and sin that we're all in. And we're all completely comfortable in this state of judgment and darkness. Completely comfortable in it and completely oblivious to what it deserves: judgment and God's wrath. We're like that picture of the little cartoon dog who's sitting in a burning house in the kitchen, and it says, "It's fine, everything's fine." Some of y'all know what that is, but we all know the world isn't as it should be. And we love this darkness that makes this world what it is. We love our sin, is what John tells us in John chapter 3. And when it comes to loving sin and loving darkness, we're fine with trying to fix all the implications of sin and darkness while actually ignoring the reality of sin and darkness that pervades this world. Secondly, being blind to our real need is such a scary thing because we're also missing out on something that's so much better than this state of things that we're currently in. We have no clue. And as Jesus interacts and engages with each of these people, they have no clue that what he intends to offer them is so much better than what they're comfortable with in the present. The same is true with us. We have no clue. And so you and I, we need these conversations. We need these conversations that Jesus extends and initiates. We need these conversations because they're both exposing and effective for our souls. And we're blind and we're clueless. And the good news is this: that God initiates these conversations. He's not waiting for us to figure it out, to wisen up enough to go and ask him what we really need, what our deepest need is. No, he comes to us as a small baby who grows up in this world perfectly. He speaks the very words of God. He is the very word of God, the message of God to people who don't get it. He initiates conversation with people who don't understand, who are blind, who can't see. And he sends his son into this sin-distorted world to real people with real needs. Not just physical or material needs, but deeper needs. And so as we continue to move through this gospel, and we see these interactions between Jesus and sinful people, blind people like you and I, we can know that we need this God who initiates. We need him. So in this passage today, there are two concentric circles that are happening in this text. There's what's happening concerning this lame man that we'll see here, but then there's the larger storyline of what's taking place throughout John's gospel. Beholding for believing. And this man, what happens to him, it plays a pivotal part in advancing the larger narrative of what's taking place in John's gospel. And so concerning this lame man's story, there are two points that we want to look at here today. In verses 1 through 9, we'll see grace for the guarded, followed by healing for holiness in verses 10 through 17. Grace for the guarded and healing for holiness. So let's look at grace for the guarded in verses 1 through 9. Jesus, he comes to the pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem, which means house of mercy. And inside of this pool, there are a lot of people with disabilities. Blind people, lame people, paralyzed people. They're weak, they're vulnerable. And if there's ever a time where nobody wants anything to do with these people, it's now. During a feast where you have to be ceremonially clean. See, according to the law, these were the people who were ceremonially unclean. And Leviticus chapter 21 says that priests couldn't even go near them. But now here's Jesus, right? Our high priest, the purest of the pure, the one who truly mediates between God and man, and he pursues people like this. He pursues the unclean. He sees this man who's been an invalid for 38 years lying there at this pool of Bethesda. And he supernaturally knows. He knows this man's situation, just like the Samaritan woman. He knows that he had been there for a long time. And so what does he do? He initiates. He graciously initiates. And he asks this man a simple question. Do you want to be healed? A question that is loaded with the fullness and freeness of God's grace. And notice, he doesn't extend this question to everyone there who's at this pool. And also look at verse 13. He doesn't even stick around afterward to find out to see if he can do any more miracles there. He leaves. He withdraws. This miracle is specific. This grace is specific. It is just for this man in this scenario. So Jesus initiates. He pursues him specifically. And that tells us a little something about the freeness of God's grace. Yes, it indeed comes to a lot of people, but it comes specifically to you, to me. God sees and God knows our situations, our lives, our sin. And when grace comes to us, it's not just a broad blanket, a sweep of, I'm just going to be gracious. But it does come specifically to broken, sinful people like you and I. This grace comes to this man, but he's guarded. He's guarded. What does that mean? We'll just look at his response in verse 7. Sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me. Now, some translations, they try to include it here as an extra verse, but there was this belief that the waters of this pool, whenever they were stirred up, they would provide healing. And whoever could get to these waters first, whenever they were stirred, would be healed. And so this man here, he's 0 for 38. 0 for 38 years. There's no telling how many times he's tried to get to this pool unsuccessfully. That's why he's here, and that's why he's been here. And so real quick, this man's response, it reveals a few things. It's more than just a statement of the obvious. Let's just read it like a human, right? Firstly, it highlights a misplaced solution to his problems. Jesus, he asks him a simple question. Do you want to be healed? And what does he do? His mind immediately jumps to the pool. I've just got to get to the pool. Healing is at the pool. Healing is connected, directly connected with the pool. Now, why does he say this? Well, maybe he says it because he's ruled out the supernatural completely. It's been 38 years. This is his only option if things are going to get any better. Or maybe he's been embittered that it's been 38 years of paralysis with no solution. Whatever it is, he's so locked in on the pool's powers being his only solution for healing that he can't fathom any other way. This is it. So now that's his play, that's his strategy. Get to the pool, get to the pool, get to the pool. But he keeps failing. He keeps falling short. And so he tells Jesus, I'm trying. I don't have anybody. I'm too slow. Someone else gets there quicker than I do. And that leads us to the second thing. Beneath this answer, right? He's got something to prove. See, Jesus wasn't really looking for all that for an answer, right? And neither are we when we ask sometimes these simple questions and people just go on and on. It's like, I wasn't really asking for that, but thanks for sharing it. Jesus wasn't really looking for all that. It was a simple question. Do you want to be healed? But again, read it like a human. Confronted with his own limitations, his own weakness and insufficiency and inability, this man responds defensively. And he deflects a little bit. I imagine he probably hears the question like this. Do you want to be healed? And so now he paints himself as the victim in this whole situation because, listen, he has nobody. I don't have anybody to put me in the pool. But he's also blame shifting too. Everyone else gets there faster than I do. They're faster than I, and I don't have anybody. Do you want to be healed? Yeah, I do, but I mean, hey, I'm doing what I can. I'm trying my hardest. Again, Jesus didn't ask for all that, but this man, he's got something to prove. Maybe to Jesus, but probably more to himself. He works hard enough. He tries hard enough. He does everything that he can within his own ability to get to this pool, but it's not enough. And so now, when presented with this question that confronts him in this way, he's evading a little bit, blame shifting, trying to justify his failures of not getting to the pool. Again, Jesus doesn't ask for all that. But in this man's mind, the pool is the solution. A misplaced one, yes. But notice, it's left him working more and trying harder. Working more and trying harder unsuccessfully, while at the same time still trying to preserve himself, to preserve his dignity, to justify himself. Again, maybe in his own eyes. He's just like us, right? We're so complicated. Beneath this answer, which seems so simple, is this web of complex emotions and feelings. See, in the same way that he's looking to this pool water for the solution to his brokenness, brothers and sisters, you and I, we are spiritual invalids who keep looking to all kinds of pools to heal our brokenness. Pools that we believe will offer us meaning and satisfaction and life and healing and wholeness. And if we can just get to the career, right, or the perfect spouse, or having enough money, or enough pleasure, or enough morality, then it'll produce the kind of wholeness that we're looking for. If I can just get to the pool, get to the pool, get to the pool. That's our aim. That's our strategy. But let's be honest, right? We all fail to get to these waters just like this man. We fail. And we're left working more and trying harder. Every day, every week. And also, whenever we're confronted with our own brokenness and insufficiency, confronted with why we haven't achieved what it is that we are looking for and seeking, then just like this man, we're guarded. We become defensive. We've got something to prove. We blame shift. We become victims in our own situation. I'm trying. I mean, if I just had better circumstances, if I just had more help, if I just was born into maybe these particular situations. All in an effort to preserve ourselves, right? I'm trying. I'm working. I need help. And that leads us to the third thing. What do we do in these moments when we are looking to self-justify? When we're looking to work, do more, and try harder? Well, it reveals the third thing. The third thing this man's response reveals is more passive here, but he's now going to use Jesus. He's going to see Jesus as someone who can be helpful to him to get to whatever he believes will give him wholeness. He's going to use Jesus to help him get to whatever he believes will bring him wholeness and healing. See, misplacing the solution will now cause him to misuse Jesus. He sees Jesus, and this is all he's good for in this moment. Someone has walked up to him and has asked him, "Do you want to be healed?" And he's, obviously, this guy wants to take me to the pool. Jesus, if you could just lift me up and pull me over there right in front of the pool, I can get there a little faster. If you just move me a little bit closer, I can do it. I'm quicker than that guy over there. And we're the same way, right? I mean, listen. This is like asking Bill Gates to co-sign your mortgage or your student loan. Like, what? It's an effort to simply use someone greater, someone who has sufficiency within them to meet a specific need and a problem for something else. See, many, if not all of us, we take religion, even Jesus, environments and settings just like this one, and week in and week out, we do the same thing. Jesus, will you help me get blank? Will you help me get this? Because that is where true healing and true wholeness is found. Jesus, if you could just help me get obedient kids, help me to get lasting friendships or a job that provides enough money, then that would bring me wholeness. See, what happens in that moment is that our need for Jesus becomes subservient to our need to find whatever we think will give us life. Again, for this man and for us, the solution is misplaced. He's trying to prove something, and he's misusing Jesus. Let's just add his name and our names to the list of people who, when Jesus initiates the conversations with us, we can't see. We can't see who and what we really need. See, this man thinks he needs the pool. But as Jesus is standing there in front of him, what he essentially says to him next is, "I am the pool." Look at verse 8. "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." This is the fullness of God's grace that is poured out on guarded people who are trying to prove themselves. God's grace, it freely gives us what we don't expect, what we don't deserve, even when we're not even looking for it. That's the freeness and the power of God's grace. It ends the race and the cycle of us trying to prove ourselves, doing more, trying harder. God's grace is for weak people who cannot justify themselves. People who say, "I cannot get to the pool. I'll never get to the pool. I don't have it in me." It disarms our defensiveness. And God's grace puts us in a position to simply say, "Yes." Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be whole? Do you want to receive fullness of life? Stop saying, "I'm trying. I'm working. I can't. I don't have the solutions or the resources." Hey, God's grace frees us to simply acknowledge our weakness, acknowledge our insufficiency, and say yes. And so at once, the man was healed, and he took up his bed, and he walked. Listen, Jesus is gracious. Jesus is abundantly gracious so that you and I don't have to prove ourselves. Jesus is gracious so that we don't have to blame shift or justify our failures and our insufficiency. He's not looking for us to prove ourselves. He's not looking for us to get it all together before he extends to us healing and wholeness and life. No, he pours it out abundantly and freely. Will we believe Jesus? Will we believe him? God himself has pursued us and he has initiated the interaction that leads to our wholeness, our freedom from darkness and sin's power. He's initiated the interaction that leads to our experiencing restoration and life. Do you want to be healed? If the answer is yes, a disarming yes, then stop ducking. Stop evading the truth about yourself. Disconnect your desires for meaning and wholeness and satisfaction from all these things in the world that tell you that you've got to work more and try harder in order to get their promises. Disconnect your desires from that. Stop trying to get to the pool that won't satisfy and won't heal. And believe Jesus. Believe who he says he is. Believe and receive what it is that he gives. Moving on, we've seen grace for the garden, and now we'll see healing for holiness. The restoration of this man's wholeness, it won't stop with his unresponsive legs. Jesus intends for his life-giving power to reach his unresponsive heart, his unresponsive heart towards God. So again, look at this passage. If you didn't get it from his initial response to Jesus, right, a sort of a web of complexity, this is the kind of guy who's defensive, right? He's somewhat evasive for the sake of self-justification and self-preservation. He's a guy who's trying to move the target off of himself. Presented with a question that he's got to answer directly, again, he feels like, I've got to move the target. I've got to blame someone else. I've got to give a list for my justification for my reason why I haven't gotten to the pool. It's always someone else's fault, or he's usually the helpless person. Again, he gets asked a question and he deflects. He points to someone else, or he points to his own weakness or his own ignorance to get himself off the hook. I have nobody. Someone steps down before me. Hey, it's not my fault. And now that starts to carry over in his next conversation. Look at verses 10 through 14. This man, he goes to present himself to the Jewish religious leaders, most likely looking to give thanks to God and also for a change in his societal status, moving from unclean to clean. And this healing, it just so happened to take place on the Sabbath, right? And the Sabbath, it was this God-ordained, designated day of rest, which we see all the way back in the book of Genesis chapter 2, where according to the Jewish religious leaders who interpreted the scriptures, the word of God, you couldn't even take up your bed and carry it on the Sabbath. You had to cease from all daily work because God rested on the seventh day. You couldn't do anything. Even if you just so happened to be a lame person who found your legs on the Sabbath. The law essentially said, listen, you can't find your legs on the Sabbath. It's illegal. And so now notice again, this man is singled out. He's singled out. He's asked a question, not in a good way this time, because now he's kind of in trouble for breaking the law. And the punishment means that he could either be jailed or possibly stoned, a death sentence. And so again, in the spirit of evasiveness and self-preservation, what does he do? He blame shifts. He blames the guy who healed him. The man who healed me, that man, that guy over there, him, he said to me, take up your bed and walk. Same response, right? Now, sure, we know that Jesus withdrew as soon as he healed this man, and so it's not like this guy absolutely knew who healed him. But if you want to know what he could have said in this particular situation and why his response is, again, so cringy, just flip over to John chapter 9. It's the same situation with a completely different response. In John chapter 9, it's a situation that takes place on another Sabbath with another disabled man. It involves another pool, more Jewish leaders, and questions. But again, a different response. And so this blind man, when asked who healed him, he doesn't look to evade or preserve himself at the threat of these Jewish leaders. He tells them this: it's Jesus who healed me. And this Jesus, he's a prophet. He's a prophet. You should listen to him. And then he argues for that and pushes back repeatedly against these leaders and tells them that no matter how many questions that they ask him, no matter how many questions that he answers, you're still not going to listen what this blind man says. You don't really want to know who healed me so that you can listen to him. You want to know for other reasons. And so he says to them, finally, this is amazing. This blows my mind. Y'all don't know where Jesus is from. You're calling him a sinner, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he listens to him. He goes on to say that throughout history, no one has ever heard of someone opening the eyes of someone born blind. If this man were not from God, he wouldn't be able to do anything. This formerly blind man is now given a boldness and a confidence and even a trust in Jesus that could potentially jeopardize him, even his own life, his family status, his status at the temple. What he says to them essentially is back off. He's not evading or avoiding the spotlight or the target. And consequently, he's thrown out of the synagogue. He's cut off from fellowship. Later, Jesus finds him in the same way that he finds this man here. And this man believes. He becomes a disciple. And he worships Jesus. But that's not what happens here. Flip back to John chapter 5. Look at verse 14. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you're well. You're well, man. Sin no more. Stop sinning so that nothing worse may happen to you." Come on, man. Really? Is what Jesus says? Really? See, Jesus never heals as an end to itself. It's not just a good work. We're just doing something good for the sake of doing something good. It's meant to point to something. This healing of physical inability and physical weakness is meant to point to what Jesus brings in restoring and healing and bringing wholeness, spiritual wholeness. It's meant to show that he'll bring wholeness to our much deeper need. Ultimately, the elimination of sin and darkness and its effects on this world. That's what this healing and every other healing that we see throughout Scripture is meant and intended to point to. The coming of God's kingdom into this world that will eliminate sin and its effects. Calamity, sickness, suffering. All the things that we see in our world every single day. Jesus walking into a synagogue, into a place and healing this man, healing a blind man, exhibiting healings that he does, is meant to point to the day when God will restore this entire created order. And this man, he misses that. That's what this is about. Healing for holiness. Healing for spiritual wholeness. Now, some people think that this means that this man's former disability, it was connected to or even caused by some particular sin or pattern of sin in his life. And that Jesus is telling him this because he's already committed some sin which has caused this illness. He's been made well now, so listen, don't return or continue in this sin, this particular sin, or something worse is going to happen to you, particularly God's judgment, something that Jesus talks about in the next passage. What's worse than 38 years of infirmity? 38 ages of torment and eternal separation from God. 38 million ages. God's judgment and wrath. So what Jesus is telling him is lean into life all the way. Not just physical wholeness and restoration, but spiritual wholeness, holiness, alignment with God. And so this assessment that it may be tied to a particular sin in his life, it's not false. The Bible does indeed teach us that all sin brings and deserves death, but it also teaches that the consequences of some sins manifest in ways in this life, whether illness or suffering or death. And so listen, brothers and sisters, as you think about that, as you read the scriptures and think about that, that sometimes sin does bring consequences. Sin does merit particular illnesses and suffering and death. Don't try to work through all the sin in your life. Don't put it in one column over here and all the bad things that have happened to you in another column and try to draw lines to bad things that have happened to you to particular sins. That's not the point here. Listen, we all live in this world where sin, my sin, your sin, our sin, and particularly the sin of our first parents is the reason behind all of the calamity, the sickness, and the suffering in this world. And yes, sometimes we can draw a line to a one-to-one relationship between our personal sin and some particular suffering or consequence. And sometimes we can't. But overall, what the Bible teaches us is that because of sin's destructive power, both in our contributing to it and our being affected by it, that's the reason that all suffering exists in this world. And so as God's people, whenever we see sin and the brokenness of this world in our society, whenever we scroll through our news feeds and timelines and turn on the news channels or experience the calamity and chaos and suffering, the abuse, the murder, the rape, the abortions, and all the things that we see, the racism, the wickedness, the darkness that we see that pervades our world, whether we contribute to it specifically or are affected by it personally, we should grieve all sin. We should always be a people who grieve and lament over sin, because we see that our sin, my sin, your sin, has contributed it to it in a way that we can't draw a line to it. But it has contributed to the calamity in this world that God will judge. And we should be a people who grieve sin. But we should also have hope, because we can know that Jesus seeks to set us free from sin. He is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He will take away sin. And that's why he comes into this pool of Bethesda and extends wholeness, physical wholeness, to this man. Because he wants to point him to the reality that he will eradicate sin. And he will bring spiritual wholeness to all who believe and trust in him. He will remove sin finally, its presence, its power, and its penalty. That's what he's pointing this man to and exposing through initiating this second interaction. He wants to expose his deeper need, our deeper need, that we are healed for holiness. Again, this man's greatest problem wasn't this absence of physical wholeness, but the absence of holiness and the presence of sin. And that's our greatest problem and our greatest need as well. So brothers and sisters, listen, I don't know what this man's specific sin was. You and I, we don't have that kind of knowledge. Jesus does, and he knows what he's talking about. This man knows that Jesus knows what he's talking about. But whatever this specific sin was, it's rooted in the exact same spirit of self-preservation and self-seeking that he's continuing to display here before the religious leaders. And our sin, however it manifests itself internally or externally, is rooted in the same exact thing, the same exact wickedness, self-preservation, self-seeking, evasiveness. I mean, look back at Genesis chapter 3. It's the same thing that Adam and Eve do in the garden, right? You remember? God comes to them. He initiates. Hey, it's that serpent over there. It's this woman you gave me. Man, that is the nature of sin. We seek to preserve ourselves. We self-seek to defend ourselves, to justify ourselves. And we aren't open towards God. We don't know his sin, but whatever it is, Jesus knows it. And it's not so flagrant that he ignores this man altogether, but he specifically pursues him, right? He pours out healing on him graciously, abundantly, knowing how shady he is. He doesn't hold back or withhold. He doesn't wait for him to come to him as if he's the pool and he says, I just need you to come a little closer. No, he goes to him and he pours out his abundance of grace. And he doesn't tell him sin no more before healing him as if this man needed to earn his wholeness. No, Jesus pours out and extends grace to him freely first, breaking the power of sin's effects over his life. And then in light of that, he tells him this, you're free, man. You're free. And because you're free, you don't have to sin or keep living in this way that has caused you so much trouble and pain and darkness. Again, he's just like everyone else. He's comfortable in this darkness. He avoids the light. And Jesus says, you've been healed for holiness. You've been healed for holiness. But if you choose to keep going down this road of sin, if you're going to choose to mock this healing and turn away from this grace that was abundantly poured out on you freely, then something worse than 38 years of illness is coming. You'll bypass the grace that has been displayed and revealed through Jesus, and you will continue on in the wrath of God. Whoever believes in the Son has life, John chapter 3 says. But whoever does not believe, whoever sees the Son and keeps moving, the wrath of God remains on him. And listen, Jesus says the same thing to us. He has extended grace to us freely, not on the basis of how good or bad or moral or shady you are. And he's broken sin's power over us at the cross so that we might live a life of holiness for all who believe and trust in him. And that concept, that word of holiness, it doesn't just mean moral purity. Yes, that is what is communicated, but it's just a life that's aligned with God, his person, his work, his character, his will, loving the things he loves, rejecting the things he hates. This life of holiness, holiness is a life that's rooted not in self-justification, not in self-preservation, but one that's rooted in self-denial. Self-denial. Whoever would follow me, let him take up his cross, deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Self-denial and dependence on Jesus alone. Displaying just what this man did at the pool. Trusting and believing in Jesus at all costs. And again, that's not to earn his grace, but it is a response to his grace. So listen, it's sobering that Jesus' words don't immediately do in this man what they did in the Samaritan woman or in the royal official. See, even if it means jail for this man or rejection from the temple for breaking the Sabbath, choosing Jesus seems like an obvious choice. You don't meet people like this who solve your greatest physical need and also your greatest spiritual need in a span of hours. And what you really don't do is you don't receive that from them and then just snitch on them in the next 10 minutes. Who is this guy? He's us. We despise grace as well. This man doesn't choose Jesus. Instead, in verse 15, this man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. This isn't the same boldness the blind man displayed. This is moving the target. This is self-preservation. Because remember, who was charged initially? It was him. It was him. But now, who's being charged? Who is the target moved on? Jesus. And so for this man, the choices are no jail or Jesus. Fear of man or grace of God. Self or Savior. And in another act of evasiveness, this man chooses the former. And now watch. In the saving of himself, his actions will ultimately lead to the destruction of Jesus. See, in telling the religious leaders that it was Jesus who had healed him, he's now given them all the ammunition they need to persecute Jesus and eventually kill Jesus. Man, that's just too bad for Jesus, right? Like, all this abundance of grace poured out for this kind of response. Well, grace is never wasted. It is never wasted. It is abundant. It's limitless and full. And it will do what Jesus intends. Again, it will expose this man's need so that he will either believe in Jesus or God will be justified in this man's receiving judgment and wrath. Grace is never wasted. And now this is where it fits in the larger story. See, in his selfishness, this man probably doesn't intend to be one of the first betrayers of the Son of God. But isn't that how sin always works, right? It's way more than what we ever bargained for. He just thinks he's getting off the hook, but now he is betraying the Son of God. But don't feel bad for Jesus. He's good. This is exactly where he wants this situation. Remember, he's sovereign and he's strategic. He knows exactly what he's doing by going to Jerusalem during one of the most populated feasts of the year and then healing this man on the Sabbath, allegedly breaking the law. He knows what he's doing, y'all. He's leaning in. And the religious leaders, they fervently seek to preserve this Sabbath, a day when nobody's working. And Jesus now, he answers them and says, "My Father is working until now." My Father is working until now. And none of them would have disagreed with that first part of the statement. See, historically, when it came to the Sabbath, none of the Jews believed God actually stopped working on Saturdays. All these religious leaders would have affirmed that God takes no days off because it's his world, it's his universe. People keep being born on the Sabbath, people die on the Sabbath, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, God is at work, upholding and sustaining the universe by the word of his power. But Yahweh was the only one for whom there was an exception on the Sabbath. And so what Jesus is doing here is he's saying that in the same way that God is at work in his domain, in the same way that that exception applies to Yahweh, it applies to me too. My Father is working until now, and so am I. I am working. I am working in my domain. And so, yeah, it's a statement about the Sabbath, but it is bigger than the Sabbath, way bigger than the Sabbath. It's a claim to divinity and equality with God. God is his Father. He is God's Son. And that'll lead us to the question that we're going to ask next week. What does it mean to be Jesus? But before we close, why does Jesus heal and work on the Sabbath? This won't be the first time or the last time, especially if you read the Gospels. Jesus looks to intentionally heal people and do good things on the Sabbath. Why does he do it? Well, again, God is working. And God is working because this world needs work.
See, if you remember the initiation of the Sabbath at the beginning of creation, where the Lord rested on the seventh day, creation was good. It was whole. It was complete. But at the entrance of sin and brokenness and death into this world in Genesis 3, God went back to work, restoring, repairing, redeeming, and he is working until now. God is working through his son. How? What's he doing here in the pool of Bethesda? He's giving life. He's giving wholeness that'll both point to the day when life will overflow in creation again, when death shall be no more, when sickness shall cease, and when sin will be eradicated from this entire created order. He is working now. He's working on restoring, repairing, redeeming. But he's also working in this way as well. He's working here as Jesus is betrayed by the very man that he healed, bearing the charges of death for breaking the law that this man deserved. This man who got to walk free. The charge that was attributed to this lame man who was healed will now be attributed to Jesus. He will bear what this man deserves. This man who got to walk free. And that's a picture that will point to God's greatest work through his son. Jesus bearing the punishment and the penalty of lawbreakers like you and I. People who despise the grace of God. Who betrayed Jesus time and time and time and again. But for all who trust in him, he bears our penalty. He bears the punishment for our sin. And in exchange, he gives us healing and wholeness. Jesus will be killed in the place of people like this man. And he will be crushed in the place of people like you and I. And if you believe and trust in him that his finished work is for you, his perfect life lived, his sacrificial death, and his powerful resurrection, if you believe him, beholding his greatness, and you and I, we can be made whole and experience life forever. Let me pray for us. Jesus, we come to you, firstly, just lamenting sin, lamenting our sin, our specific sin. And if we zoom out sin's presence and power in this world, we grieve it. But we have hope because you have come into this world to take away sin. And God, even during this season, help us to reflect on that in a way that we don't often think about, that we forget, as we are so prone to trying to just get to the pool of meaning and life and satisfaction and so many other things. Forgive our sin, Jesus. Have mercy on us. And we thank you that you are the true house of mercy, the true house of spiritual healing and wholeness. You are everything that we need. So as we grieve and lament sin, help us to trust in you for life, for wholeness. Help us to turn from sin and to believe in you. We praise you and we thank you for bearing the punishment and the penalty for our sin so that we might walk free. God, help us not to despise that, to despise the freeness of your grace, but to see that we have been healed for holiness so that we can walk in your will. To obey you and serve you and love you, not living lives of self-justification and preservation, but lives of self-denial, depending on you for all things. Jesus, make this clear to us as your people. We ask these things in your name, amen.